This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations. Futuro.
When we cross the actual border, that's where it all hit in. Like, I'm going to a place, I have no idea how it looks. I don't know a lot of people. I mean, I cried the whole trip, but at that point I knew that I was on this side already, in the Mexican side, and that there was nothing I could do anymore, that I was here and I had to make something out of it.
From Futuro Media and PRX, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Today, for the 10th anniversary of DACA, the untold stories of undocumented immigrants forced to return to Mexico. This year marks the 10th anniversary of DACA, a policy put in place under pressure by activists by former President Barack Obama in 2012. It defers the deportation of hundreds of thousands of then young undocumented immigrants who had arrived in the U.S. as children. President Joe Biden's administration refers to DACA as an extraordinarily successful policy that has benefited more than 800,000 people. But that's not the whole story. After a decade in place, DACA still doesn't offer a pathway to legal permanent residency or citizenship, and Congress has failed time and time again to pass legislation that would provide stability for these immigrants. In this episode, we're going to introduce you to Maggie, Madai, and Esme, three young women who left the United States both before and after DACA was implemented because of the U.S. government's inability to offer them a sense of what a clear future would look like. They are just a few of the thousands of immigrants who have made the difficult decision to return to places they hadn't known for years, leaving their families behind and even putting their lives at risk with this decision. Still, life goes on, even if it's hard. And these three women found each other on the other side, and they formed a community they didn't even know that they needed. We're going to start with Maggie Loredo. She's 31 years old now, and she's the oldest of the three women we're going to meet.
Being part of an immigrant family, I mean, since I was like 10, I was very active in my family first. Like, I had to interpret at hospitals.
Maggie arrived in the U.S. in 1993 with her family, first to Dallas and then to Dalton, Georgia, where she grew up.
I taught English classes and citizenship classes at a local Latino clinic. I was also an interpreter at an elementary school for parent-teacher conferences. In the hospital, I think that was one of the best experiences. I was there almost 2 years. I volunteered in the general area, but then I moved to the maternity area and I started to do a lot of work with moms and in the nursery.
But as an undocumented immigrant, there was always something looming behind the work she did.
I think I was trying to prove everybody else that I needed to be here, that this was my home, that I was someone that was giving back to the community.
By 2008, Maggie was about to graduate from high school and wanted to go on to college. She looked into applying to scholarships for undocumented students, but their funds had run out. She asked her teachers in school, but they didn't even know how to help her. At that time, DACA didn't exist, and the DREAM Act, first introduced in 2001, didn't seem to be going anywhere in Congress.
I really understood that even though I had grown up here and even though I had done all this work, at the age of 18, I was going to stop having rights in this country.
Maggie had to make a choice. She decided to go back to Mexico and try and continue her education there. She had just turned 18. Here now is Maggie telling her own story.
I don't think I was hopeful. I mean, I think I was just doing something that I wasn't even sure I wanted to do it, but it seemed like it was the only thing I could do. I gathered a bunch of recommendation letters because I knew if I needed a job, I could show all of these letters. I did call the Mexican consulate and I tried to prepare all my school documents to revalidate my U.S. studies in Mexico. I left Georgia and I went on a van with like 7 men and 1 elder lady. I was going to Cañada de Yañez. It's a very small village in San Luis Potosí, and it was like a 30-hour drive. When we crossed the actual border, that's where it all hit in. I'm going to a place. I have no idea how it looks. I don't know a lot of people. I don't have a lot of communication with my relatives. I cried the whole trip since I left Dalton. But at that point, I knew that I was on this side already, in the Mexican side, and that there was nothing I could do anymore, that I was here and I had to make something out of it. So I think I was just more in a quiet, silent mode at that moment. I remember that I got up the following morning, and I remember that I didn't even want to go out the room because I knew I was going to have to talk to people. Eventually, I ended up going outside, and the first thing I saw was my grandma's altar. My grandma had passed away like 2 years before. When I saw the altar, I did have memories of my grandma. I started to just look at all the walls in the house, and I saw photos of me, like school photos of me on the walls. And I thought that was very strange because I didn't even know my parents had sent photos of me. I went to the bathroom and they didn't have like a flushing toilet or like a bathtub or a shower or anything. It was just all with little buckets. And you had to heat your water on firewood. Everything felt very strange. And I think at that moment, I started to really regret what I had done because I left everything I had in the U.S. for this. I think the next months I started to connect with people there in the village, but then eventually I moved to the capital of San Luis Potosí and I took a bus. I took the wrong bus and I got lost, but this bus went to like the wealthy area of San Luis Potosí. So at first I was very confused. I was like, why am I seeing these big houses, these big streets? They look clean. These cars look like new cars. I had never seen the wealthy area of anything in Mexico. And I saw a sign at a building that said that they were looking to hire a receptionist. And it was an English school. So I got excited. I looked up the name of the school and then I applied. I got hired to be a receptionist, but I became salesperson, English coordinator, babysitter. I even got to manage the entire school by myself. It ended up being a very toxic space where there was a lot of abuse from my bosses. I tried to revalidate my U.S. studies and it was impossible. They told me that there was no way I could do it in San Luis Potosí capital and that it was like an in-person paperwork I had to do. And I explained that I couldn't go back to the United States. I went like at least 10 times or more, and I explained my story like 100 times every time I went, and they would never know where to send me, like to which department. It's a huge building. And finally, I found the person like months later, and that's what the person told me, like, you need to go back. I'm sorry. And that's it. At that point, I was already working at the English school, and my bosses used it as a really good opportunity to really just tell me, this is the best thing that can happen to you, this job, because you don't have a degree and you don't have references and you don't even have high school. So just like, this is your opportunity to be successful in this job. So take this advantage. I was also very alone at that moment, that I invested myself in that job 24/7, giving everything of me. And they were just using me. They were just exploiting me. It became really ugly. And then I finally quit that job 3 years after. Around that time, my mom came back to Mexico. We moved to another place a few months after my dad returned as well. So they rented like a place and we opened a store. And I was in charge of that store. I was in a very bad mental state because by that time, it was already 2012. I still wasn't in college. I was taking care of a store that was recently opened. So like there were no clients. I literally would spend the day just cleaning and hoping a fly would go by. So it was very disappointing and depressive. I really felt that I had let down a lot of the people that believed that I had a really bright future. I was in my house that evening when Obama came out and gave his speech.
This morning, Secretary Napolitano announced new actions my administration will take to mend our nation's immigration policy, to make it more fair, more efficient, and more just, specifically for certain young people, sometimes called dreamers.
And I was sitting there and I was in shock because I knew that he was talking to me. Like, I felt like he was speaking to me. Like, I was that kind of person he was describing.
Put yourself in their shoes. Imagine you've done everything right your entire life. Studied hard, worked hard, maybe even graduated at the top of your class, only to suddenly face the threat of deportation to a country that you know nothing about.
I was that person. I was very active with my community. I had finished high school. I wanted to stay. That was the only place I knew as home. And the only thing, or the only reason I knew he wasn't talking to me was because I was in Mexico.
We'll hear more from Maggie later, but coming up, you'll meet Madai Zamora, who was in the U.S. when Obama made that announcement. She got DACA, but still, Madai decided to return to Mexico. After the break, you'll hear why. Stay with us. No te vayas.
Support for Latino USA comes from Odoo. If you feel like you're wasting time and money with your current business software, or just want to know what you could be missing, then you need to join the millions of other users who switched to Odoo. Odoo is the affordable all-in-one management software with a library of fully integrated business applications that help you get more done in less time for a fraction of the price. To learn more, visit odoo.com/latino. That's odoo.com/latino. Odoo. Modern management made simple.
Hey, we're back. Before the break, we heard from Maggie Loredo, who returned to Mexico in 2008 after graduating from high school because she didn't see a future for herself in the U.S. as an undocumented young woman. 4 years later, in 2012, DACA was created, and Maggie did meet all of the requirements except for the fact that she was now living in Mexico, and there wasn't a path to DACA for someone like her. That same year, 2012, in North Carolina, Madai Zamora was just graduating from high school.
I was one of the first to admit to the counselor that I'm undocumented. It was scary but liberating, and that's just who I was. I was undocumented. I couldn't fake otherwise.
Madai is now 28 years old. Back then, she had applied and gotten into her top college choices. But without papers, she couldn't afford to continue her studies.
That's when I really felt betrayed by the whole system.
Even after the DACA announcement, which some saw as the solution to all of her problems, Madai knew it was never meant to be a long-term fix for immigration. Hear now Madai's story in her own words.
I had always wanted to move back to Mexico since I was little. For me, that American dream that everyone, you know, that our parents believed in, I never believed in it because I always saw life elsewhere. I had planned to move to Mexico. I ended up taking a gap year to work and save money to come to Mexico and go to college. But that's when Obama announced DACA. I remember the day clear as light. My phone started blowing up. Everyone started calling me and texting me to turn on their news. The thought was, okay, but this is an executive order. This is not something stable. What is going to happen in 4 years? Because in 4 years, whether we like it or not, Obama is no longer going to be president. It was a struggle if I was going to apply for DACA or if I was just going to leave. And eventually, my family won, and I applied for DACA. I applied to Janssen C. Smith University, and that's where I ended up going. So there was only a handful of Hispanic students. We were all either undocumented or documented. You're in college. You want to party. You want to have fun. You want to do all these things. But because you're undocumented or documented, you constantly have to think of, like, no, because if I get pulled over, it's game over. I struggled my senior year in high school, trying to go to college and trying to figure out what I was going to do. And then again, my senior year in college, the Republican Party announced that
Donald J. Trump has been selected as the Republican Party nominee for president of the United States.
It was just a stressful year because hearing all the rhetoric, feeling more racism around me, because living in the South, it's always kind of there, but it's very subtle. But once Trump started saying everything he said, and you felt the tension even more.
There we have another state to project. It is the state of North Carolina, big battleground state. It's going to Donald Trump, 15 electoral votes. He is filling in that map.
The day of the election, I just went to bed. I did not want to watch it. And I remember I woke up around 3 or 4 in the morning and I texted my husband, boyfriend then, like, what happened? And he told me,
Donald Trump wins the presidency.
I just wanted to tell everyone in my family, I told you this would happen. Because his main goal, one of his main goals was to take away DACA, to end it.
The executive order gets rescinded. One good thing
you'll
about...
You'll rescind that one, too?
One good thing
you'll
about...
You'll rescind the Dream Act executive
you're
order,
have to,
the DACA.
We have to make a whole new set of standards.
At the time, my husband, he was like, half joking, half serious, said, I'm just going to leave and get things started for us in Mexico. And we all kind of like laughed about it. But his half joke turned into a reality. And in January 2017, He came back and he's been in Mexico ever since. He asked me to move here. I said no the first time because I couldn't bear the thought of being away from my family, because I knew that if I left, it was going to be a minimum of 10 years before I could even attempt to get a tourist visa to go back and visit.
The president on Twitter today claiming the recent crackdown on undocumented immigration is, quote, keeping a campaign promise. ICE agents have been rounding up hundreds.
And between January and February of 2017, there was a lot of raids that started happening. And there was just this fear that started to come back into our communities. It started to get to the point where I didn't even want my mom to drive or my aunts to drive.
Tonight, around the country, restaurant kitchens are empty, factories are deserted, and schools quiet.
Dozens protesting downtown in front of the Immigration and Customs Building, or ICE, and fighting for the rights of undocumented workers.
There was a really big protest of like a day without an immigrant. I remember all of us and my family, we participated, we all went. And my mom ended up getting fired from her job. I just got so angry because that was the reality that we were living in. To me, it affected my depression again and my anxiety again. And I had to go back to therapy and I was back on antidepressants. And it was just to the point where I didn't know what to do. I graduated in May 2017 and I didn't have a job lined up because in North Carolina, to be a teacher, they weren't giving professional licensures to people that had DACA because it's unstable. The year passed. It was 2018, and I was still uncertain. It was the beginning of the year. Me voy, no me voy. Like, I'm leaving. I'm not leaving. I'm going. I went to my therapist, and I told her what was going on. And she's the one that pushed me, like, are you happy? No. She told me, so what are you still doing here? If leaving to Mexico is going to make you happy, then why don't you make the move? And so that was like my little snap out of it. And I went home and I bought my ticket. I didn't tell anybody that I bought the ticket until a couple weeks after. My mom was the first one that I told. I took it to my bedroom and I sat her down and I told her, I bought my ticket to go to Mexico and it's a one-way ticket, obviously. And she took it rather well. I think she saw it coming. The whole purpose of going to the United States is so you don't come back, because it's seen as you're going to go back to poverty or your parents' sacrifice. Va valer para nada. Like, it's not going to be worth anything if you go back. It was seen as you're giving up. But for me, it wasn't like that. I had always wanted to move back to Mexico since I was little. When I was in the airport in Charlotte waiting for my airplane, it was June 27th of 2018. I thought I would be nervous and anxious, but it was one of the most calmest moments that I have felt in my entire life. That first month literally was spent traveling. We went to Chapultepec, we went to the pyramids. You know, we like explored Mexico City, then we went to Oaxaca and we ate so much food and everything was just so new to me and I was so excited. It wasn't until November that it hit me that I was in Mexico. I was working at a school that I did not like. It was a Catholic school. I had to hide my tattoos. I had to teach a certain way that I did not like. So I was very unhappy. And then I ended up getting typhoid fever from the food. And so I ended up going to the hospital. I spent like 2 days in the hospital. I was sick. My job responded in a very negative way to me getting sick. And then Thanksgiving rolled around. And my family FaceTimed me. And like, Madai, we miss you. How are you? And obviously, while I was on FaceTime, I was just smiling and talking to everyone. But as soon as I hung up, tears started rolling down my face because that's when it really hit me. I didn't want to complain to my husband because he had already gone through his mourning and his sadness and his depression. That's when, like, my low point started after moving. We didn't have a car then, so we had to use public transportation. And I hated getting on the bus because even before pandemic, I didn't like people touching me. And so on the camión, there is no personal space. Everyone is touching each other, your, you know, bodies against each other, trying to squish more people in. And so I struggled to get used to that because in the United States, I had my own car. I was up and down, going everywhere by myself. So I felt like my independence was taken away from me for a little while because I had to depend on public transportation. I had to depend on my husband. He had to go on a business trip and I got on the bus by myself. And I was assaulted on the bus by a man. I got off of the bus before my stop. And I ended up walking home about 30 to 40 minutes. I got home super sweaty, super ugly, and I just started crying. And I hated life and I hated riding the bus and I hated my job. And I couldn't talk to anyone about it. Slowly, I started to get in a routine. I learned what buses to take, and it got easier. I ended up quitting that teaching job in January of 2019 because I was just miserable. I was still kind of lost and unsure of what to do. And so that's where I was like, I would like to share, you know, my adventures. And so I started to make my YouTube channel. Hey, guys! So, I originally started Diary of a Native Foreigner. Like, it was born out of my depression, in case you guys didn't know. Like, I was like,
what should I name it?
Because my first year here in Mexico sucked, and I hated everything, and I hated everyone. And
I am a Mexico native because I was born here. I'm also kind of a foreigner because I don't know it at all. I can barely speak Spanish to begin with. And so that's where the idea came that it was going to be my diary. And so that's where the name came from, Diary of a Native Foreigner.
We got goodies from the States. My mom and my sister sent us Christmas presents. I got like hot Cheetos, American hot Cheetos, and sunflower seeds and some other goodies.
It wasn't easy, but Madai had managed to start finding her way in Mexico. She missed her family. And she also knew that as an undocumented immigrant who left the U.S., she was barred from returning to the U.S. for at least 10 years. She won't be able to apply for a tourist visa until the year 2028. It's a tough reality, but she at least has been able to plan for it. And that's not always what happens. As in the case of the third and last young woman we're going to meet, Esmeralda Flores, or Esme.
Once I figured out I was smart, I brought it upon myself to do everything I could to excel because that's the only way I thought I was going to get my version of the American dream.
Esme is 30 years old, and her return to Mexico was completely different than Madai's. She was a stellar student in South Carolina. In 2010, she was offered a full scholarship to go to college. She was going to study chemistry, then go on to law school to become a patent lawyer. But one day she got a call. It was the administrative office from her college telling her that they couldn't honor her scholarship because she was undocumented.
And I was like, what do you mean? Like, do you realize I can't go to school without the scholarship? And they were like, yeah, I know, I'm very sorry, you know, but we can't give it to you because you're undocumented. But what we can do for you is if you happen to get a student visa, then we can give you a scholarship for the same amount as an international student.
So she did what made more sense to her and what the college had actually recommended. Esme went to Mexico to apply for an international student visa, and she's going to tell her own story from here.
I I graduated May 29th, 2010, I believe, which was a Saturday. And a week later, on June 5th, 2010, which was another Saturday, I was taking a plane to come back to Mexico City. I didn't bring anything, just a couple of clothes, and that's it, you know, because I was going back home. When my mom found out that I was coming back, she decided that she was going to come back with me and stay because she had gone through a really hard time in the U.S. because there were family problems, problems with my dad, and she was also alone. I mean, my dad had his family, but my mom didn't, right? It was just her. For the first weeks or so, I was waiting for a power of attorney from my sponsor so I could get the documents in check and then ask for a visa appointment. And then we finally got the power of attorney and we went to the bank to ask for this letter that you're supposed to get. And they tell me at the bank that they cannot give me this paper I am requesting. I ended up in the Cámara de Diputados, which is like the House of Representatives here in Mexico. It wasn't really until that appointment that it hit me. Because I was sitting there waiting to talk to the secretario, and then some lady came up to me and started talking to me, asking me why I was there and whatnot. And she was like, oh, that's very impressive, but you should have stayed in the U.S. because the government does not support its students here. And then I got to the appointment with this, with the diputado, with the representative. And then he was like, this is very impressive, blah, 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 but there are no funds available to help you. And so when he tells me this, like everything that that lady had said, like came back to me and I was like, oh my God, what have I done? Like, really, what have I done? For a moment there, I kind of was in a bit of denial. My sister, she was very mad, said some very hurtful things. Because this kid was my best friend, my little sister, like almost like my daughter. My family was kind of disappointed. My sister was disappointed because she missed me. But my family was like, should have stayed. You should have waited. We'll pay you the coyote. Come back. But me being the stubborn person that I am, I was like, no, if I'm going to come back, I'm going to come back with a visa and they're going to ask me to come back. In the U.S., I had never drunk. I had never smoked. I had never had sex. I was like the definition of Miss Goody Two Shoes, right? And when I got here, even though I was pretending to be okay and I enrolled in school, I started drinking and I had a bit of an alcohol problem, honestly. And so I would honestly sometimes show up drunk to classes. And even so, I still got the second highest grades in my class. And so it was like, if I can come to school so drunk that I trip over a bench before one of my final exams and still get a really high grade, then is this place even worth my money? So I dropped out and then I got into a call center where I worked for 2.5 years. I would take calls, get drunk, take calls, get drunk. It was a really dark time professionally and emotionally. It was fun sometimes, and I learned a lot about myself. The call centers are a really weird place. I mean, just think about it. You put a lot of people that are returnees and deportees that have gone through similar situations in the same place. It can get kind of not healthy. This capitalist system has figured out that if they deport us and then make us work for a lower salary here in Mexico, that it's really good for them. For a woman, especially in this city, in a state where there's 10 feminicide a day, saying that you're a returnee or deportee is announcing to the world that you're alone. And that is not safe. We have people that have been verbally and physically attacked for speaking English in Mexico because we don't look white, we don't look foreigner, so it's not acceptable for us to speak English. And then DACA got announced. I saw it. I felt bad about it. Probably drank it away, the sadness. Because what was I going to do? Cross the border as a 19, 20-year-old woman by myself in this border that is nothing like it was before 2000. And what am I going to go back to? Being undocumented was so hard. I'm going to be very honest. If my mother had not come back with me, I would have probably died. Like figuratively and metaphorically of sadness. Or like literally being run over because I didn't know what to do in this big city, right? I mean, I grew up in the middle of nowhere, South Carolina. One day, I woke up from a 3-day consecutive partying with obviously the biggest hangover in the world. And I woke up and I was like, dude, I'm 21. Like, what am I doing with my life? I need to get my stuff together. And so I started taking a Spanish course and a Mexican history course. And I was like, if I'm going to do this, I'm going to do this right. And I'm going to do this the way I know how to do, right? And I'm going to apply for the faculty of law. Even though I had these things going for me, I still thought, how do I get back? How do I get back to my sister? And so when I was in sixth semester, which was like in 2016, I applied to an international law competition because I was like, maybe if I'm here, right, I can get the visa. I actually applied that year for my visa for the first time and it got denied. And that's when it was like, I'm still doing everything just to go back. I started going to immigration forums, and I remember looking at the flyer and at the itinerary, and it said, Maggie Loredo, Otros Dreams in Acción, testimonium about being a returnee in Mexico.
It was the same Maggie who we heard from at the beginning of this story. And when we had last heard from Maggie, it was 2012, and DACA had just been created. But now, 6 years later, Maggie was in a completely different place. She had connected with other returnees who helped validate her high school diploma in Mexico. She had also told her story in a book called Los Otros Dreamers, The Other Dreamers, published in 2014. That put her in contact with even more people who had been deported or who had returned to Mexico. So, here's Maggie once again.
All the work that I had done in Georgia sort of came back to me because I was part of this community and I was meeting all these people.
A year later, Maggie and Jill Anderson, the book's coordinator, founded ODA, Otros Dreams en Acción, Other Dreams in Action, in order to organize and support people who grew up in the U.S. and had returned or had been deported to Mexico.
We knew that our first project would be a community center, a cultural center. At that moment with the community, we consulted, how do you want to name this space? There were so many options like the crib or something. I don't know what else. And it ended up being Pocha House.
Pocha House, in order to reclaim the once derogatory term that other Mexicans used against those who have lived in the U.S. and speak a kind of Spanglish.
We always envisioned that Pocha House would be a space where people who had experiences of living undocumented in the U.S. or growing up undocumented in the U.S., that there would be a space for them to just come and know that they could speak Spanglish, know that they could talk about their experiences, know that they could find resources.
They provide information on how to navigate Mexican bureaucracy in order to access healthcare or education. And they also organize politically to change the narrative of what it means to be a deportee or a returnee. Ultimately, they care for a community that has been largely ignored by both the U.S. and the Mexican governments. And it was because of Oda that in 2018, Maggie was at the immigration forum that Esme was attending.
And I remember thinking, great, another sad story, right? Another sad, sad testimony. I was like, oh my God. And then it wasn't. And then it was great. And then it was her telling all the government officials that were there that they were at fault, that they were not doing enough, that they were not doing us a favor. And I was like, whoa. And of course, some parts were sad because it's sad. Family separation sucks. But I remember this other epiphany moment when she was talking. She was talking about her brother and she said, but nobody's ever going to give me back the time I didn't have with him. And it hit me. I was like, it doesn't matter if I get my visa now, today, this very moment. Nobody's going to give me back the years with my sister. Nothing is going to be the same. So why focus all of my life on going back? This is what I want to do, right? I want to do what they did for me. And so I applied for the coordinator of accompaniment and I got in, and everything has been better ever since, because I feel like the emotional support was something I needed from people that knew how it was to be a returnee or a deportee, you know, like how it was to not have family that can always back you up.
To Esme and Madai, Maggie became an inspiration.
We joke and we say that Maggie kidnapped us and got us involved. I just felt so happy because that feeling of being alone was gone. And all I wanted to do was, how can I be part of it? How can I help give this happiness and ease to someone else?
For Maggie, the uncertainty after leaving the U.S. has been transformed into a real kind of purpose and meaning.
I don't know what I was searching when I made that forced decision to come back to Mexico, but I think that now I understand a lot what I was looking for, and I was looking for a community.
Community building is more than just politicizing. It's also creating bonds and having friendships, long-lasting friendships that support you, you know, like that will throw you a baby shower, that will go to your graduation, who you can have Thanksgiving with if you have nobody else to have Thanksgiving with. We don't call it Thanksgiving. We call it Día de Acción en Resistencia because of the genocide tied to Thanksgiving.
Hola a todas, todos, todes. Qué chido verles en esta bocha de tanto tiempo.
We now spend that dinner evening as a community, not only thinking about our loved ones in the U.S. and our families that are separated, but also recreating new traditions and new laughs and new moments with ourselves as a community.
Hola, yo soy Yudan. Estoy agradecido de haber conocido a Oda este año.
Hola, yo soy Dani. Yo agradezco poder estar aquí y conocerlos a todos.
Hola, soy Madai. Estoy agradecida porque Oda ha sido mi safe space. We brought American hot cheetos.
Okay. We get the chance to reconnect, to have fun, to share a meal, southern cooking that we all miss.
Okay.
This has to smell good.
Yo, and I'm gonna get you some of
the meat. It fills my heart with so much joy to be in this physical space with everyone that I know shares similar stories, similar fights, and we all believe in the same thing, and we're all part of this same community that is just here for each other without any judgment.
I'm gonna go this way.
Oh, what's this?
It's unclear how many people living in Mexico have similar return stories as Maggie, Esme, and Madai, because there are no official records tracking this specific community. But estimates from the Migration Policy Institute suggest that between 9 to 15,000 people who would have been eligible for DACA had already left the United States for Mexico before the creation of the program in 2012. And there's no data available for the number of DACA recipients who have returned to Mexico. On July 16th of 2021, DACA was ruled unlawful by a federal judge in Texas. The U.S. government may continue to accept new applications, but is temporarily prohibited from approving them. Current DACA recipients can retain the ability to stay and work in the U.S. while the program continues to be challenged in the courts. This episode was produced by Victoria Estrada and Patricia Zulbarán. It was edited by Julio Ricardo Varela and mixed by Julia Caruso and JJ Carubin. The Latino USA team includes Andrea López Cruzado, Marta Martinez, Daisy Contreras, Mike Sargent, Julieta Martinelli, Reinaldo Leaños Jr., Alejandra Salazar, and Julia Rocha, with help from Raúl Pérez. Our director of engineering is Stephanie LeBeau. Our associate engineer is Gabriela Baez. Our digital editor is Luis Luna. Our fellows are Elisa Baena, Monica Morales, and Andrew Viñales. Our theme music was composed by Zenia Rubinos. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again on our next episode. And in the meantime, look for us on all of your social media. Y acuérdate, no te vayas. Chao.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. The Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide. And the Heising Simons Foundation, unlocking knowledge, opportunity, and possibilities. More at hsfoundation.org.
I was telling them that my throat is sore because I've been yelling at my kids at school.